Welcome, everybody, to the February 17th meeting of the Senate Business and Transportation Committee. We've got a number of bills that we're going to take up very quickly, House bills, and then we'll probably spend the majority of the meeting on House Bill 4036.
Reed's here.
What?
Rep. Reed is here, so 4020.
Yeah. 4020. So we're going to start open a public hearing on House Bill 4020. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 4020 replaces the requirement that management companies and state agencies that are under contract with the Oregon Growth Board invest a specified amount in Oregon with rulemaking authority for the board to require investment in Oregon. It has an emergency clause that become effective upon passage and signature by the governor. There is a fiscal impact that's indeterminate from the House side. It has no revenue impact. There's no amendment. And this came to us with a House vote of 59-0.
Representative, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'm Tobias Reed from Beaverton. I intend to be very quick. I am one of the legislature's ex officio non-voting members of the Oregon Growth Board. I think it fills a critical role in meeting capital gaps for growing Oregon businesses and is doing good work. My role today is to introduce the co-chair of the Oregon Growth Board, Jerry Langler, who will take you quickly through slides about why this bill is needed and about its urgency. Appreciate you hearing the bill. Hope you'll move it out today.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, Vice Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jerry Langler from OVP Venture Partners in Portland, although today here serving as the co-chair of the Oregon Growth Board. And Heather, why don't you introduce yourself now?
Sure. For the record, my name is Heather Stafford. I'm the Assistant Director of Innovation and Entrepreneurship at the Oregon Business Development Department, otherwise known as Business Oregon.
So, Chair Beyer, I think we'll just take a couple minutes here and go through, if I can make this thing go forward. Here we are. Whoops. It's working. Yep. I don't know. Maybe we're going to have to go to paper here. Do you have, does the committee members have paper?
I think we have it's Run slides, Patrick.
Oh, got it on hold.
That is the way I'm thinking. Maybe I can. Getting some of the slides, but not all.
They'll have the hard copy.
Okay. All right. Well, just a second. And
it's on all of us. Thank you.
So the first slide says OGB has two main elements. It's just, I recognize you folks here from many, many boards and commissions here. Just a quick reminder of what the Oregon Growth Board is about. It consists of two pieces, the Oregon Growth Account, which has been in place since 1999, so long before this board was in place, and the Oregon Growth Fund, which was put in place by the legislature in 2013. Today we're here only to talk about the Oregon Growth Account, which is the larger piece. It's about a $100 million pool. And its objective is to take a small fraction of lottery dollars, invest those through investing organizations, I'll come to those in a moment, to help fill capital gaps across the state. And the results of that are designed both to help grow those businesses, but also return dividends, if you will, to the Education Stability Fund. The Oregon Growth Fund, which you see at the bottom of the page there, is much more targeted on economic development only without a worry about returning capital and growth to any other organization. Again, we're not here to talk about that today, just the Oregon Growth Account piece. So if you flip to the next slide, which says OGA success requires access to the top private equity funds, again, those dollars go into the Oregon Growth Account, which then we as a board decide where to invest that into private equity partnerships, who in turn invest in Oregon companies and other companies. It's not all in Oregon companies. The companies that are successful return money to those funds. We get our piece of that back, whatever fraction of that fund we were. And we can either reinvest that and continue that cycle, or we can provide dividends to the Education Stability Fund as we have. So that's how the money flows. And if you go to the next page, it says the OGA side letter issue. The issue really arose here because the Department of Justice changed the interpretation of the original law in 2007. Before that, everybody understood that the OGA's purpose was twofold, again, to fill capital gaps and provide returns. The DOJ ruling said that as part of every investment that we would make, we would require those private equity funds to sign a contractual obligation that for every dollar we invested in them, they would invest a dollar or more in Oregon companies. And on the surface, that seems quite reasonable. The problem with the unintended consequences is the really strong private equity funds don't need our money and won't sign that letter, and we can't get into those funds. And so we essentially end up with a negative selection bias. We can get into the weaker funds, but we can't get into the stronger funds, even though as part of our selection criteria, we are doing everything we can to make darn sure that those companies are going to invest in Oregon startups. And we monitor them closely. And in fact, you know, if they don't perform, I'll come to what happens then. But what we want to basically get to here in the proposed legislation is change the word shall to the word may and allow us the flexibility that when we can get that side letter signed, we will. But if we have a very strong private equity partnership that does not need our money, that won't sign it, we have the ability to relax that condition. Now, again, I should come back around to what happens in both cases with and without the letter. And this is really important because the remedy if those private equity partnerships do not invest in Oregon is the same. If they have signed the side letter as it exists today and they don't invest in startups in the state, we first essentially call them on account. We will bring them into public meeting in front of the board and ask them what they're doing and why they haven't and what they're doing to change that. And if they still don't by the end of that fund, our remedy, our real remedy, is to not invest in any successor fund of theirs. And nobody wants that. Nobody wants to lose an investor because that's a black mark on you. We can't practically sue them for performance because if we do, no other private equity partnership will ever take our money again. They just won't take that risk. So in the case of with the side letter or without the side letter, our remedy is, you know, first public accountability followed by public shaming followed by no follow-on investment in a future fund. So that's why we think that the presence of the side letter requirement does us no good but only harm in trying to have our two-headed thing of filling capital gaps and providing returns to the Education Stability Fund. Now, if you turn to the next slide, which says the side letter does not create higher in-state investment, in fact, one of the interesting things is we do have an A versus B case here because up until 2007, the side letter was not required, and after 2007, it was. And so we went back and looked at the in-state investment by those partnerships who received money from the Oregon Growth Account 2007 and prior versus those 2008 and after. And it turns out in both cases, we're getting more than a dollar bang for our buck on the in-state investment. The average is about $2 for every dollar we invest, so that's working. And even in the most recent time, it's 1.2. But the fascinating thing is before the side letter was required, we got more than $2 investment in Oregon companies for every dollar we invested. And after it, we got 1.2. And that's counterintuitive, perhaps. I cannot tell you why, because we don't know. But I can speculate, since I am in a private equity partnership myself, I think it's quite possible that the weaker funds who were getting invested in post-2008 and on were looking for quicker exits. They're trying to show progress faster to their investors so they could get to be bigger, stronger funds. And so they got in and got out faster rather than building larger, sustainable companies that would benefit Oregon if they hung in there. Again, I can't promise you that's the cause, but to me it's the most likely explanation that I can come up with. Next slide is the Oregon Growth Account has dug itself out of a huge early hole. One of the things that we clearly are very conscious of is the overall performance of this fund over time, again, because we are responsible to the Education Stability Fund. And you can see that, you know, long before any of us were involved, when the Oregon Growth Account was started in 1999, it was the worst time in the history of the world to invest in private equity, particularly venture capital. And the returns here of negative 25% in those early years show that for those funds, those bubble year funds. Now, to date, I'm pleased to say the Oregon Growth Account is in the black. 2.5% positive. But more interestingly, post-bubble, so 2004 to present, it's 6.75% compound return. And The more recent funds, 2009 to present, are north of 9%. So the fund is doing its financial duty in terms of providing attractive returns that, in fact, are right up there with the new PERS targets or above, and yet still providing the capital gap filling exercise. One thing you will note in the bill in 4020 is an emergency provision to get this executed quickly. And the reason for that is very simple. Every month that goes by, more funds come to market. And if we basically let more time go by, those are funds, some of which we would like to get into that we can't. If this bill does pass, we would like to be able to act immediately to get into the top funds that are in the market today. And there are actually a couple right now that we're looking at strongly. Final slide, the Oregon Growth Board economic impact slide, to show you the impact of what happened after the last full session when this was in proposed legislation and did not pass. We had a $40 million funnel of funds that we felt were appropriate for the Oregon Growth Account to invest in. We wouldn't do all of them, but those were ones that already met our screen. That dropped to $15 million on July 1st when the side letter didn't pass, because there were $25 million of activity that would not sign the side letter. And just for anecdotal reference, I'll include a couple of interesting things that we've missed. On my wrist, some of you would recognize this little black band. It's a Fitbit. One of the venture funds that invested in that firm is True Ventures. We wanted to invest in True Ventures. In fact, they have already invested in Oregon multiple times, so it's not like we're trying to drag someone here kicking and screaming. They're already here. We want to continue to encourage them to come here. They're investors in Fitbit. When Fitbit went public, it not only was something like 40 times their investment that they made in that one deal, it paid for all four of the funds they had ever raised by a factor of two.
Paid it back.
So that's the kind of thing we've missed by not being able to have the side letter waived. Finally, just a couple other quick points. You'll see there over time, the Oregon Growth Account portfolio companies are now coming up on 150 Oregon companies have been funded this way, creating upwards of 800, over 800 incremental jobs and supporting more than 2,000 existing jobs, and have generated over $150 million in payroll. There's one error on your slide there. It says the Oregon Growth Account has delivered $23 million to the Education Stability Fund. That was as of June 30th. We delivered $4.3 million more in December, so it's actually north of $27 million now.
Let's see if there are any questions.
I actually have one. Yeah.
Any questions? No? Guess not.
I got one.
You got one. I'm sorry, Senator. Go ahead.
Real quick. I'm still hung up on the remedy if you have a bad actor. Most financial worlds, there's a price to pay. And shaming someone for taking free money doesn't seem like it would be very effective. Can you kind of elaborate how you don't end up with a bunch of bad actors?
Mr. Vice Chair, Chair Beyer. So the shaming isn't all, right? The real issue is you don't invest in their next fund. And these funds come to market every 3 or 4 years. And so if they have limited partners, which is what we are as a limited partner, who don't come back, other limited partners initially want to look at that and go, what happened there? What's wrong with that picture? To date we have had a couple, two at the moment actually, who signed the side letter, who have not invested in Oregon. And they're now coming back. We've already told one of them, don't darken our door. And so they, told them to go away. But suing for performance would mean to try to recapture that capital. And again, that if you think that, we have a problem today getting into the top funds as a state entity, suing limited partners for, not if you will, fraud or anything, obviously terrible, just not investing in Oregon companies would scare them off. And I can tell you, again, as someone who manages a lot of limited partner money, nobody wants a litigious limited partner, but I will tell you that we've only had two, and all the others have met the test, including those who didn't sign the side letter and those that did. Part of our job as a board is to screen them ahead of time so that we have a high probability that they will meet the test, either because they're already here, they're already investing in Oregon, so we know they're coming, Or I have one other example of a fund that turned us down because of the side letter, where I was on the board with one of their people of one of our portfolio companies in Idaho, and they wanted to come to Oregon. I've known these people for 5 years, and they looked me in the eye and said, yes, we want to invest in Oregon, but, you know, give us some motivation. So, but I understand your question, Senator, but we're very conscious of it.
Okay, other questions? Guess not. Thank you.
Thank you.
So all I had signed up. Does anybody else wish to comment? Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Didn't mean to cut
just
you off.
Yeah, I know you have a full agenda. I'll be brief. For the record, my name is Heather Stafford. I'm the Assistant Director of Innovation and Entrepreneurship at Business Oregon. It's an office that's only existed here since April, so just under a year. And we divide the work up into three general buckets, which is innovation, which means Oregon Innovation Council. We manage all of those signature research centers and initiatives under the council. And entrepreneurship, we also manage the RAIN Project, the Regional Accelerator Innovation Network in South Willamette Valley, and the Oregon Growth Board is the third bucket, which is really our capital tool. And none of those other things, innovation and entrepreneurship and ecosystem building for young companies to grow our own, happens without access to capital at various stages. So we also produce the Oregon Capital Scan, which identified a lot of different capital gaps. And what this tool allows us to do as a state agency for economic development is really fill those capital gaps, to look at how can we be more strategic with the funds that we do invest in, to align them with the kinds of Oregon industries that we're trying to grow. So now that we have this strategy together, where we're linking up the clusters we're trying to build and we're linking up the capital that's available, this is really the only tool we have to leverage any of that capital. It also is a great tool to retain our firms. We lose a lot of companies to the Silicon Valley and various other capital-rich states because their venture firms sort of lure them away, pull them away, because either they don't have a match here in the state of Oregon, or they don't have an investor in Oregon at all. So they oftentimes leave right when they're about to bring on all the jobs that we're hoping to create. As I said, we're building industries. We're also trying to build a resident capital in the state and leverage private money. So angel investors, these are private individuals who are accredited investors, wealthy enough to put their own money to work. The growth account and actually really leverages all of our angel conferences, angel groups that perhaps become even early stage small venture firms, and then we can leverage those large venture dollars to bring their money here to Oregon. And now that it's all tied underneath our agency and allocated or aligned with the strategy of what we're building, it's just an incredible tool that we find a lot of value in.
Thank you. Again, any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing, open a work session. Do you want to move it, or do you want me to?
Sure. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4020A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Gerard's moved House Bill 4020A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion.
The only thing I'd like to say is I honestly think we need to keep an eye on this a little bit. I do have concerns with the remedy. And so I just think we need to keep an eye on it, but I think it's a good bill.
Don't disagree. Anybody else? Is there any opposition to the bill? Seeing none, House Bill 4020A moves to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation. Would you like to carry?
Sure.
Senator Gerard will carry. We'll close on that. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4140. Representative Gomberg. Patrick, you want to kick us off here?
I think, Mr. Chair, this bill, House Bill 4140, prohibits the release of sky lanterns at Oregon Airspace, makes it punishable by a maximum fine of $2,000. The vote on this on the floor is 54-3. There's a minimal fiscal no revenue, Mr. Chair.
Trying to take all the fun out of life, huh?
Rather, Mr. Chairman, I'd say we need to focus our fun and make sure we actually are having fun. But good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. District 10 on the beautiful Oregon coast. And I am here with one of the more inflammatory, perhaps incendiary measures of the session, the Sky Lantern Bill. And I just wanted to explain very briefly, it wasn't that long ago that that I stood up on the floor of the House carrying a similar bill, a bill that was introduced by Representative Mike McClain. And my floor speech that day was very succinct. I said, colleagues, this measure prohibits the lofting of open flame, untethered devices over state forest lands during burn season. Duh. Duh was the extent of my floor speech that day. And I have another duh bill for you today, which is an extension of that very bill. And the reason I brought you a new bill is because I think circumstances have changed since I carried that bill that says you can't send flaming devices over our forest lands. And what has changed is the 2015 fire season. During the 2015 fire season, we had 1,048 fires. We burned 87,000 acres at a cost of $76 million. 779 of those fires were caused by humans. So that's part of what I came to talk to you about today. Oregon is dry. Oregon is subject to fires. And it is certainly not a time, in my opinion, that we should be sending fire off into the sky in an uncontrolled manner, no matter how much fun it might be. So what is it we're talking about, these Skylanders? I provided the committee administrator with a couple of samples, and I hope he could pass them around for you. But what we are talking about are lightweight paper.
Everybody lit them up, and they went away.
These are lightweight paper balloons with a metal frame, and you attach to those balloons a high-intensity flammable cube and let them off into the night sky. I was able to pick up a package of a dozen of them on the internet for about $12. So when they work as they are supposed to, the worst that happens is that we get a bunch of chemically treated paper littering the countryside. But unfortunately, what too often happens is that the flammable cube isn't properly attached, and after you ignite it and let the thing loose, the cube falls off. Or the very flimsy paper that you see before you tears and doesn't fully lift, veers off in another direction, falls out of the sky, and suddenly you've got these open flame devices landing in the tree, landing on your shake roof, landing at your local gasoline station. I mean, essentially what we've got is a flying sterno can, colleagues. And I have some concerns about that. In all fairness, the devices come with some very stringent instructions, and it says to read all safety instructions carefully before launching. Instruction number 3, wait for that the heat, enough light. Lantern's person less loose, a top hand changes grips under the light to encircle, has when the lifting force may let go, release for flying. There are other instructions here that are a little more clear. Keep away from trees, power lines, and buildings. Stay at least 5 miles from an airport. Do not fly toward buildings, trees, airports, roads, or any area that may pose a danger. Keep a bucket of water or sand close by for emergencies. Only launch with responsible adults. Do not use during prolonged periods of dry weather. Don't launch if torn. Don't use if could be misinterpreted as a distress signal.
I think we're getting the point, Representative.
I would just simply say, I would add one additional instruction, don't use them at all. What we've really got going on here is these devices have been prohibited in 29 states already. The National Association of Fire Marshals recommends that they not be used anywhere. If we pass this bill, they still will be used, just as illegal fireworks are still used in Oregon. But what we do is we give fire marshals the opportunity to respond to awkward or potentially dangerous situations with an appropriate tool.
Okay. Are you sure they don't qualify as kites?
No strings attached. No
strings attached. I was going to say the same thing.
Questions of the representative.
I'd like to point out something. This is the Senate. Our attention span is rather short. So we prefer short speeches, but that's okay.
Questions?
Thank you so very much.
Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 4140? Seeing none, we will close public hearing. We'll open a work session on 4140. Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 4140 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Rods move House Bill 4140A, is it?
No.
4140 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? There is none. House Bill 4140 passes to the House or to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. And Senator Riley, would you like to carry this?
Sure. I'll take a stab at it. Yeah. I'll let it fly.
We'll close on that, and we'll open a public hearing on, do we want to do 4141?
4117, yes, Mr. Chair.
On House Bill, open public hearing on House Bill 4117. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This measure eliminates the requirement that Landscape Contractors Board offer the option for a practical skills test for persons applying for a landscape construction professional license or any limited or specialty license offered by the board. It requires the board to offer a practical skills test option for at least two types of limited or specialty licenses, reduces the schedule for offering practical skills tests, allows practical skills tests to include written multiple choice questions, allows business practices classes to include a test, but prohibits the board from considering the test results for conditioning or refusing a issuer license. There's an emergency clause, so this measure would take effect upon passage and signature. It has minimal fiscal, no revenue, no amendments, and comes to us with a floor vote of 55-0. And Representative Hurd is here to speak to the bill.
Representative, welcome.
May I have the agency director come up?
You betcha.
Oh, wow.
Elizabeth.
Okay. Well, I will do the best I can to tailor my testimony to the short attention spans.
Thank you.
I suffer from the same thing, so. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for allowing me to come testify on my bill today. I am State Rep Dallas Hurd of House District 2, Roseburg, down to just north of Grants Pass. Good folks, great place. I'm bringing before you today House Bill 4117. It is a simple technical fix bill to the greater bill, which we passed in the 2015 legislative session, which was House Bill 3304. The intent of that bill was to simply allow more options for individuals in this state to apply for landscaping licenses so they can start their own small business and whatnot. A lot of folks worked hard on this in the interim to create House Bill 4117. We simply were trying to work together, myself, the agency, and also some folks from OLCA have submitted, which is the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association. They have submitted a letter of support, which should be in your materials. As far as I see it, all sides that would be concerned with this bill are in full support of the fixes. It simply reduces the cost and difficulty of the implementation of the testing for the agency. I feel like they have shown that they are willing to give a good faith effort to fulfill the requirements of the legislature, and this was my attempt to come to the table with them and try to maybe, you know, pull back a little bit on some of the more difficult parts of putting this test into place. It's something we're trying to phase in over time so that it doesn't cost the state too much, but it cracks the door open for new individuals to become licensed. As a landscape construction professional of my, like myself, I know the difficulties of passing the state's test. It's designed to be a minimum standard to show proficiency. I found it as a written-only exam to be a very difficult obstacle to overcome, but also, in my opinion, not always the best test of whether you're good at landscape construction. So I'm really excited about the fact that we're going to do a real skills test. Just to hit quickly on the emergency clause in the bill, the reason behind that, because I am not typically a fan of those clauses, is the reason for that is because we have a mandate from last year that we issued to the agency that there are timelines they must meet, and so this allows them to still go ahead and meet those timelines with that emergency clause. Quickly, if I may, I'd like to just hit on a quick story that from an encounter I had in this last fall here of 2015. I had a walk-behind skid steer, which is a useful tool in landscaping that I had listed on Craigslist. A gentleman from Portland actually came down and purchased it from me. He was a young first-generation American from Mexico and had good English-speaking skills but still had a heavy Spanish accent. Although the Spanish translation that was in the bill from last year is not part of this bill, I still want to brag on it a little bit. He was really excited once I explained to him, because he was not licensed yet, but he was pushing that way. He was doing some side work and whatnot, which is, again, part the greater reason, one of the great reasons why we put this bill forward, was to help more people come out from the shadows to be licensed and excuse me, and legal, And so I was really excited about how enthusiastic he was. He said, you know, as a Republican, I felt it was important to give, and it really doesn't matter which party, but it, for me, I wanted to give people who have a difficult time reading our language, who are trying to assimilate into the culture, a financial incentive to pursue assimilating into our culture. And I felt like that translation was crucial to helping them in that. And but finally, he was really excited about the possibility of taking a real skills test. So other than that, the final thing I'll say is I want to shine some positive light on the state director of the Landscape Contractors Board, which is Elizabeth Boxwell to my right here, and as well as Kim Gladwell. They were truly wonderful to work with through this process, and I feel like the agency is in good hands.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Boxwell.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and committee members. I am Elizabeth Boxall, Administrator for the State Landscape Contractors Board. I don't want to be redundant over what Representative Hurd has already covered, but essentially the bill that passed in 2015 did pose some challenges for our semi-independent agency, specifically around financial and human resource constraints. So the bill you have before you represents a compromised, a narrowed scope so that we can achieve meeting the requirements and meet the intention of what that bill was really intended to do and get more people licensed and allow it an iterative process. So we're looking forward to the opportunity to be able to leverage OLCA's offer to leverage their certification. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that you
Thank
have.
Thank you very much. Senator Thompson, do you have questions?
She was at the office yesterday and fully informed me on this issue, and I think she did a great job of testifying for her first time.
So you're our expert on this issue. Works
Not
for you?
Always because I want to be.
Surely the good senator has something for me, though. Come on.
A lot of industries have the same problem. The tests are very rigorous. Most of the tests are so bad that, like myself, I have a pesticide license, and we can either go to classes and maintain our hours or not do any of that and take the test. And there are very few people in all the industries that ever want to have to go back and take that test to keep up the requirements because they're so rigorous. So I think anything you can do to it's kind of a new idea to do a practical thing. I thought it was like put a shovel in the ground and do this and do that, but what they explained to me is it's an expensive, rigorous process that they do over in Clackamas.
Yes, the Clackamas Community College.
I thought once a year wasn't enough, but for what it costs to do this, I think start out at once a year. Maybe if they can get some more dollars, do it more than one time.
Representative?
And to the good senator's concerns, I have the same concerns that it is too expensive and that it is not often enough. But that is why I wanted to work with the folks at the LCB, and we're going to work hard to phase this in. No one is a stronger proponent of the concept of making things affordable and accessible for citizens of Oregon to become legal licensed landscape contractors, since we're focusing on that industry right now, because it's just the free market at work. The more people that customers have a menu from to choose from to get bids and quotes from, the lower cost of living they'll have, and the better quality of work. In my county alone of 106,000 people, there are not very many legally licensed landscape contractors, and I am severely younger than most of my competition, and that's something that needs to change. And I think this is the first step in that direction.
Well, Representative, thank you very much for fixing Senator Thompson's bill from last night.
This was not that bill.
Yes, Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just as a Democrat, I think this is a great bill, and I'm glad you brought it to us. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. It passed unanimously out of the House. So.
I heard that. Okay. Any other questions?
Well, that's not necessarily a good thing in this committee.
Mr. Mayor. How long did he take?
It's usually your colleagues on this side of the chamber that question House votes. But other than that, any other questions? We're moving on. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 4117? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing, open a work session. Senator?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4017 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
4117.
I move 4117 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Girard has moved House Bill 4117 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion? Seeing none, is there any opposition? There is none. House Bill 4117 moves to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Thompson, would you like to carry this one?
I knew you were going to ask me that. Sure.
Sure. We're adjourned on that one. We will open on House Bill 4117.
Excuse me, 4121.
I was looking at the right number.
House Bill 4121 comes to us on a vote on the House floor of 59-0. It cancels the Schedule 27 restoration of the Construction Contractors Board contested case process. The measure has no fiscal or revenue impact, and there are no amendments to the bill. And Mr. Deno from the board is here to speak to us, I believe.
Welcome. A little technical fix, I believe.
Yes, sir. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Jim Deno. I'm the administrator of the Construction Contractors Board. I, too, will attempt to be brief. I believe the shortness of my attention span rivals any of yours. House Bill 4121 is brought to you today to retain the existing laws we have on the books relating to the agency's dispute resolution process and canceling the sunset of that law and returning us to the old law that was in existence before 2011. Just to give you a little background on this issue, the agency operates a dispute resolution service that it attempts to step in when disputes arise between residential contractors and their customers with the goal of reaching a mutually agreeable settlement. The old law involved a contested case process where if mediation failed, then it went to the Office of Administrative Hearings. Facing a budget shortfall of about $1.3 million in 2011, the agency changed the process to streamline it so that now we do a mediation as we did before, but if mediation fails, then the parties can seek due process through the courts to mediate their dispute if they choose. The law, as it was written in 2011, included a sunset provision that would send the process back to the old pre-2011 process in 2017. The thinking at the time was that by that time the economy would be back, the numbers of construction licensees would be back, and hence the agency's revenues. Well, that has not happened. We're still down about 20% from where we were in 2008 and 2011, for that matter. And so the revenues are not there to return to the old process. But what we discovered in the meantime was that the new law was actually more effective in resolving these disputes. We have a higher success rate. Our mediators are very skilled. And there's more, skin in the game of the parties involved, more incentive to reach a resolution of their issues. So, the new law is more effective, and so this bill will just simply retain the existing law without making any changes to it, and cancel the sunset. So this.
What you've demonstrated or found is that it's cheaper and faster and works better for all parties with what's in place now, and you want to keep doing it.
Chair Beyer, well said. Thank you.
Okay. You have a question?
No. Hit the gavel.
Any questions of this witness? Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who wishes to comment on 4121? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing. We'll open a work session on House Bill 4121. Senator Girard.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4121 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Girard moves House Bill 4121 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion? Seeing none, is there any opposition to the motion? House Bill 4121 moves to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation by unanimous vote. And let's see, Senator Monroe, would you like to carry this one? Okay, we'll close on that, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 4048. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 4048 came with a unanimous 60-0 vote off the House. It reallocates monies for transportation projects that were funded by the Jobs and Transportation Act of 2009. It has no amendment, no fiscal revenue impact, Mr. Chair.
So, Paul, we'll make this easy. This is the standard, every time we meet, reallocation of the projects. They stay in the regions and
correct.
So forth. Okay. More to add?
Nope.
Okay. Any questions of Paul?
I don't know how we do this without Senator Starr. This was always his baby, and I always saw what was going into his district, and I was always envious. So,
well, that money by law doesn't move outside of the regions.
I understand, but it still moved into his Senate district. So, never mind.
Is there any questions before we move on this? It's the routine stuff we do each time.
Yep.
Okay, Senator. Oh, I got to close. Is there anybody else? I got to get ahead of myself. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 4048? This really is a routine thing for us. All right, we will close public hearing. We'll open a work session on House Bill 4048. Senator?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4048 to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Rod moves House Bill 4048 to the Senate floor with the do-pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion? Is there any opposition to the motion? House Bill 4048 moves to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation.
I think Senator Riley, just to keep it in the family, should do this one.
Washington County?
I'd be happy to.
Senator Riley wants to carry. We're done with that. All right. Now,
so, Mr. Chair, just for clarification, so the one bill we had scheduled for work session, House Bill 4039, we had an amendment that's on OLIS. I think there's a desire on behalf of the agency and Legislative Council to take another swing at it. It didn't work out exactly the way they were hoping to do. So
we will carry this to our next meeting.
Okay.
All right. So,
but I want to make sure that we move this bill.
We will put it up first on the next meeting.
Okay.
All right?
Yep.
House Bill, for those in the audience who are not sure, we're talking about House Bill 4039 relates to through-the-fence airports. All right, so we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 4036. Yeah. And what am I doing?
Grab them.
Yeah. Well, I was 5 minutes off, 4 minutes off from what we had scheduled.
I agree. I very strongly support this bill, so we'll make sure it doesn't get delayed.
Not bad. We only missed our schedule by 4 minutes. There they are. Do you want to do an introduction?
No, I think
they can just do it.
It's a lot of reading. I think they have
to. Welcome, representatives.
Thank you for having me.
What have you brought to us?
Well, this is non-controversial, I say.
Yeah.
Bipartisan.
Yes, we shy away from controversy. Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Vega Peterson. I am the state representative from House District 47 in East Portland. And today I'm here to talk about House Bill 4036, the Clean Electricity and Coal Transition Bill. Thank you for having us come to this informational session on the bill. I know that you're going to have folks coming up to talk about some of the details of the bill, so I'll avoid doing that in my testimony and really talk more about why we need this bill. So this bill continues the work this body started in 2007 with the passage of Senate Bill 838, the first renewable portfolio standard for Oregon. The crux of this bill is to continue that work by eliminating coal from the electricity supplied to customers of PacifiCorp and PGE by 2030. It also requires that by 2040, 50% of the energy that they supply is made by clean, renewable energy sources. This bill significantly reduces utilities' greenhouse gas emissions. It puts them on a path to meet our goals, objective for reducing carbon emissions, which, just to remind you, is to reduce them by 75% of 1990 levels by 2050. So that's a pretty aggressive goal. right now we know that 30% of Oregon's greenhouse gas emissions are made by the electricity sector. This clean electricity and coal transition plan will actually reduce that 30% by 50% by 2040. So we know that decisions are being made right now by utilities about what kind of energy they're going to invest in, what kind of investments they're going to be making for our future energy needs. The plan that we have here is going to prevent new long-term investments in fossil fuels, and it will help create additional pressure for neighboring states to retire coal-fired power plants that threaten the health of our families and our climate. We know that the cost of coal is increasing and that the price of renewables is going down. In fact, PGE made the decision to close the Boardman coal-powered plant in part to avoid the hundreds of millions of dollars that would be required to retrofit that plant because of federal rules. We know that this bill was first initiated as a result of an agreement that was put together by environmental groups, by Pacific Power, and by PGE, as well as the Citizens Utility Board. Since that original agreement was released, this bill has had much discussion and debate over on the House side. We've had over 4 hours of public testimony on the bill, and we considered numerous amendments to the bill. In fact, we finally moved the Dash 32 amendments for the bill. I'm glad the bill has had that much debate, and I'm glad it's over here in the Senate for further debate. This bill is a hugely important step for the future of Oregon's energy supply, and passing this bill will help place Oregon again in the lead for developing clean, renewable energy. So I urge this committee to pass this bill. I thank you for the time, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair and committee members, for the record, Mark Johnson from House District 52. I also happen to be the vice chair for the House Energy and Environment Committee. This bill, I think, represents a process. There's been a lot of give and take. There's been a lot of effort put into putting this proposal together. And I emphasize that at the beginning because I think the alternative that's before the state of Oregon would be a ballot measure that would not entail a process. There would not be the sort of examination, there would not be the sort of projections, and there would not be the sort of care given to ensuring that impacts to ratepayers would be cared for as significantly as I think are in this bill. So for that reason, and that's one of the reasons why I can support this effort, it's a better alternative than what I think the voters of Oregon and the citizens of Oregon are presented with the ballot measures that loom if this bill isn't successful. I also think it represents a plan. It's a long-range 20 to 25-year plan for our electrical distribution network in the state of Oregon. And that's not insignificant. Obviously, as business has the opportunity to project and to plan and to prepare, they can also, in that process, and again, control costs, control mitigate surprises, and have a predictable pathway to try to accomplish the goals that are in the bill. I'm not going to say that it's a fully complete bill. I'm not going to say that there aren't things that couldn't be improved in it. The process, obviously, we have in February is limited in what we can do. We all wish we had more time, but in the circumstances presented to us, I believe this is the satisfactory alternative to what we wouldn't be able to do or what we wouldn't be able to do if we didn't have this time in February. But I do want to highlight some of the items that are contained in the bill that are particularly of interest to me. It's beneficial to our PUDs. The public utilities are at a point where, again, the ballot measure would impact them negatively. It would limit their ability to use their renewable energy credits in a way that makes sense for them and their ratepayers. That's a big thing in my district. I know it is for many of the other representatives from outside of the metro area as well. The municipal utilities had some real issues with this bill when it first came out, particularly in sections 5 and 6. It's my understanding that those issues have been taken care of to the point that they're now neutral on the bill, so that's significant. I would also point out that the Community Renewable Association, CREA, has voiced some concerns and continue to have some concerns that we weren't able to fully address on the House side. I do believe they're going to be submitting an amendment to this committee to take care of that, regarding that 8% percentage of the total power retail market that should be a part of locally sourced community energy projects, which again are tremendous economic drivers are of tremendous significance to rural and outside of the metro area, Oregon. So I would really encourage the committee to take a serious look at that. I have volunteered, along with a couple other representatives, to lead an effort in the interim if we have to need to continue to work on this issue. So I'm committed to that, to making sure that our community renewable partners are taken care of. But I just want to also say, I guess as I move to completion here, that there are many, I think there, I haven't looked at who's in the room, but I know that there are many groups that continually say Oregon's got to show leadership in the area of climate change and in the area of environmental advocacy. This bill represents leadership. It's not following California. It's not following BC or Quebec or some of these other provinces and states. This is a different direction, and it's leadership. But I point that out because I think there's limits to how much leadership we can responsibly provide on a topic like this. And from my perspective, and I know there's other bipartisan feelings in the same area, this is as far as I think we can responsibly go regarding our electrical distribution and generation system. If we want the lights to come on when we flip the switch, I really think this represents an end point. If we're going to go beyond and do other things regarding efficiencies and so forth, we need to look in other areas. So with that, I will just be quiet, and I appreciate the opportunity to kind of tee it up for you. And I know there's some really, really smart people behind us.
Great. Thank you very much. Questions of representatives? Senator Monroe?
Yeah, Mark, what'd you do to piss off the Oregonian?
Moi? You know, it's hard to please all the people all the time, Representative.
It was interesting to see how big the font got for the Oregonian.
Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Chip.
Thank you for joining us.
For either one of you, the Oregon Public Utility Commission has provided me with information more than once documented that in Oregon, the efficiency of wind turbines is about 17%, meaning it takes on average 8 of those windmills to produce the nameplate capacity of one. And on the solar panels using photovoltaic technology, it's about 12%, requiring 8 per installations for one panel. So 12, actually. But in any case, my question is, how many acres of Oregon would have to be covered by wind farms and solar panels in order to generate 40% of the generation capacity of the state in 2030?
Senator Beyer and Senator Whitsitt, Chair Beyer and Senator Whitsitt. So I don't know that exact number for you. All I know is that we have a lot of land in eastern Oregon, and rural communities have actually been some of those that have benefited the most because of the renewable portfolio standard. They've had, I think there's been $150 million in local taxes that have been taken in by rural counties because of the solar panels and the wind industry that has gone there. In fact, another bill that I think is coming your direction is the utility-scale solar bill, which is looking at how we can increase the utility-scale solar, which is the cheapest solar that can be developed. So I don't have the answer for your specific question, but I know that we have a lot of room and a lot of communities who are really anxious to see more of this kind of renewable power generated.
Follow up, please.
Follow up.
I am from rural Oregon, and I would very much like it if that you could make that information available to the committee. Thank you.
I got a question.
Senator Drew.
Yeah. The carbon that we're taking out is in Wyoming. We live in Oregon. So I'm trying to understand why ratepayers here. I mean, you put the grid and you hit the switch. I mean, that's what they're interested in. So why should we pay for a cleanup in Wyoming when we could further clean up here?
So, you know, thank you, Chair Beyer and Senator Gerard. You know, I think that we are, we're being a leader in taking the coal out. I mean, we know that Boardman is closing, right? We're not going to have any coal power plants after, in a couple decades. But what this does is say that Oregon ratepayers are not going to pay for the cost of coal in our utility bills, that we don't want to have that, nor will we want to pay for the additional federal regulations around coal. And so that's something that we're saying no to with this bill.
More?
Oh, I'm going to weigh in. I probably
all
should.
Right.
And this is for Senator Witsit's question. And I have to tell you, being from rural Oregon, it's very, very tough to have Portland to tell us what to do with our land. It just is.
Yeah.
Heard that and before.
And I don't know where.
Can I reply to that? So, Chair Byers, Senator Gerard, I totally understand where you're coming from. I was really pleased to see this bill come out of the House floor with bipartisan support and support from, legislators from all across the state.
To follow up on that, the biggest air polluter in the state is the city of Portland. The biggest water polluter is the city of Portland. So I'd appreciate it if you'd clean up Portland.
Yes. Well, Senator Beyer and Senator Drudd, tomorrow we will be having an informational hearing on the Superfund site in my committee, and you're all welcome to take a look at that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're in informational mode now. If Legislative Council, Mark, could you walk us through this thing?
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Mark Mayer, Deputy Legislative Counsel. I was the Legislative Counsel that prepared the bill, and I was asked to briefly testify on the various components of the bill. There are quite a few components to the bill, so some of the substantive provisions I will not address. I will go through and highlight those that are, I think, probably of most interest to this committee, and explain very briefly what they do as written. And then as I go through, since I was asked to try to keep the testimony to about 15 minutes, if you have a question, just feel free to interrupt me as I go. Is that okay, Chair?
Absolutely.
All right. Or you could save the question for the end. Also, I know that PUC, Public Utility Commission, is following me in testimony. So some of the questions about implementation or other effects might be better safe for them if they are not strictly legal as to what is on the page. When I prepared the bill, I tried to draft it in a way to allow people to understand exactly where there are different substantive provisions by creating headings. As you see on the first page, the first heading is elimination of coal from electricity supply. I will draw your attention to page 2. Lines 3 to 4 are the most important substantive provision on this page. On or before January 1, 2030, an electric company shall eliminate coal-fired resources from its allocation of electricity. That is the primary substantive provision of this particular section of law. Allocation of electricity is an important definition for you to understand when you're considering this provision. The definition of allocation of electricity is, for the purpose of setting electricity rates, the costs and benefits associated with the resources used to provide electricity to an electric company's retail electricity consumers that are located in this state. I wanted to point out that in this state is folded into the definition. I also wanted to point out that the definition specifies that it's for the purpose of setting electricity rates. The next important substantive provision.
Senator, could I just clarify one thing? So that, if I understand that, this bill would not cause the closure of any coal-fired plants.
Chair Beyer, Senator Witsit, you are correct. It does not require the closure of coal-fired plants. The next substantive provision, the renewable portfolio standards provisions, which make up the bulk of the bill. I will go through and I'll highlight a couple of provisions here. The first thing on section 2 that I want to point out is that there is a distinction between this and the ballot measure, and that the stair step provisions here only apply to electric companies. The electric companies, investor owned utilities subject to regulation by the Public Utility Commission. They're the ones that have to stair step up to the point where in 2040, the year 2040, they'll be required to obtain 50% of their electricity from renewable resources. If you look on page 2, existing law is maintained for consumer-owned utilities that are subject to the large utility renewable portfolio standard, which is 25% by the year 2025. So there's a bit of a distinction there. The stair-stepping only applies to electric companies. On page 4, another important section to look at, the banking of renewable energy certificates. Renewable energy certificates can be used to meet your compliance goals underneath the renewable portfolio standard, and existing law right now says that those can be banked by electric companies indefinitely and carried forward as far into the future as possible to meet those goals. What these provisions do is they create a process by which there will be an easing into, by the year 2020, all banked renewable energy certificates can only be carried forward for 5 compliance years. These are pretty complicated provisions. I can explain them in more detail probably in my office in a better setting, but I think it is important to understand that what they do is for those banked renewable energy certificates that are obtained prior to the effective date of the Act, the law stays the same, and that's in subsection 3A. Those can continue to be carried forward indefinitely. On the next page, if you go all the way to paragraph E, lines 31 to 38, by the year 2022, all renewable energy certificates that are banked can only be carried forward for 5 years. Paragraphs B, C, and D address different scenarios where banked renewable energy certificates are obtained between the effective date of the Act in 2022 and how they might be carried forward underneath different scenarios. So those are where it gets a little bit complicated, but really the two bookends to look at here for the overall policy goals, probably paragraph A and paragraph E. Next page, acquisition of electric company service territory. There's a couple of provisions in here that you should look at. Probably the most important is on page 7, lines 8 through 13. If an electric utility, and it's important to understand, electric utility means any electric company and any consumer-owned utility that deals in electricity. So it's all the different companies out there. If an electric utility acquires service territory of another electric utility without the consent of the electric utility from which the service territory was acquired, then beginning in the calendar year following the acquisition, the acquiring electric utility is subject to the renewable portfolio standard that is applicable to the electric utility from which the service territory was acquired, and the provisions of the renewable portfolio statutes that apply to that renewable portfolio standard. And so if there is a condemnation process takes territory, service territory, away from an existing electric utility by an electric utility, then it would take that it would take the acquiring electric utility out of what currently applies to them and put them into the other renewable portfolio standard. I kind of botched that explanation a little bit, but if there's questions that I can answer.
Well, yeah, I think of all the sections, this one might bother me the most, because it seems basically we have a monopoly. Now we've created a franchise for that monopoly. Am I reading that incorrectly? Because if anybody goes in to any of their territory, then all of a sudden, not just in that, say it was one house, then their whole portfolio has to go up to 50% renewables. Am I reading that wrong?
Almost. It wouldn't necessarily make you at the 50% level unless the territory that you acquired, that particular electric utility, was at the 50% level in 2040. It would put you at what they are currently required to obtain.
Okay.
So if they're at the 25% level, it'd funnel you into the 25% level. If they're at the 35% level, et cetera, et cetera.
So Mark, just to be clear, if, say we're at now and one of the utilities is at the 25% mark, if there was an acquisition, does that mean the acquiring utility would have to hit the 25 mark but wouldn't necessarily have to go beyond that?
I would argue that the way that it is written, and it could be written a little bit more clearly, I would guess, And the provisions of ORS 4698-005 to 4698-210 that apply to that renewable portfolio standard would pick up the subsequent stair-stepping requirements.
So they would have to go, they would fall under it just like one, the two IOUs do now.
Yeah, it would funnel them into the other process.
Senator?
Follow up on that same thing. So would that just apply in the new area that they acquired, or would that put their whole owner or their whole service area?
It would put the entire utility into that renewable portfolio standard requirement.
Pretty sweet deal.
Yeah. We'll call that poison pill.
That's a
yeah.
deal. Mr. Chair.
Senator,
thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think there's a timing issue here, too, isn't there, Mark? We have, under current law, they'd basically have to address 5% within 4 years. And if this law was passed, they would have to reach 20% of renewable within 3 years. And then could you discuss the hydraulic with consumer-owned utilities and BPA power, because BPA power is not renewable?
Correct. There's two questions there. The second question is a little bit easier to answer, so I'll do that first. And that's the provision at the bottom of page 7, which essentially says that a consumer-owned utility is not required to comply with the renewable portfolio standard to the extent that compliance would require that utility to reduce the consumer-owned utility's purchases of the lowest-priced electricity from BPA. So if that agreement is basically affected by compliance with the RPS, then the RPS standard isn't going to apply to them insofar as they're required to adjust their purchases from BPA. What has been written into the law here is that that section, that carve-out, doesn't apply to consumer-owned utilities that acquire service territory. So again, then there would be that effect. So that's your first. Could you repeat the first part of your question again, sir?
So, try that one more time. So let me see if I understand this. Under current law, they don't have to meet the RPS.
If it would affect their...
If it would require them not to take the hydropower from BPA.
Lowest-priced electricity, correct.
Lowest-priced, okay. But then the section above 5A moots that?
It's actually in lines 43 and 44. The exemption provided by this subsection does not apply to a consumer-owned utility that acquires service territory of an electric company without the consent of the electric company. So it's a carve-out for acquisition again.
Without consent. So 43 and 44 essentially say Section 6A doesn't apply.
Correct.
Okay. Senator Ryder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I want to be really clear about this. A utility like the Forest Grove utility, if the city of Forest Grove annexes a portion of PGE territory and then they supply electricity to that part of the city, the new part of the city, then they fall under the PGE standard. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Almost. I think it is important to always qualify the language with the words without consent. This is really about condemnation. It's not about annexation. There are consensual means by which consumer-owned and other utilities annex other companies' territories. So this is really about condemnation.
So PGE has to consent to this for Forest Grove not to be under PGE's standards.
I think that's a fair reading of it, correct?
Thank you.
Yeah. There are some finer points here, but overall I think that's a fair assessment, as long as we understand it is about condemnation and not about just annexation.
Mm-hmm. Senator Whitsitt, we're back to the second part of your question.
The second part of the question. And, Mark, that had to do with timing. And it's my understanding that under current law, if an investor-owned utility were successful in, if a consumer-owned utility is successful in condemning a investor-owned utility's customers, they would have to comply with a 5% renewable portfolio standard in 4 years. But under this new law, they would be required to reach a 20% within 3 years.
Partly correct. It's very complicated because of where a consumer-owned utility would fall underneath the renewable portfolio standard requirements under existing law right now, depending on what their overall electricity supply is to the state. If they're at 3% right now, they're actually exempt from any RPS standard. And that lasts until, I believe, 2020. Is that correct? 2025. In 2025, then those smaller consumer-owned utilities, and most of them fall in that category right now, would have to acquire 5% under certain circumstances and 10% under certain circumstances from renewable portfolio standards, depending on how much electricity they're actually supplying. If a consumer-owned utility supplies more than 3% currently, then they're in the large utility standard in 469A140, which stair steps up to, I think we said it was 25% by the year 2025, which is existing law. So your question has to be modified in that consumer-owned utilities now fall in different RPS standards depending on how much they currently supply. The important thing to remember is that if condemnation occurs and there's annexation through condemnation of another company's territory, then they're going to be subject to that company's renewable portfolio standard in the next year.
Yes.
So hopefully that answers your question.
Mm-hmm. You have me totally confused, actually, but I think
right.
The short answer was pretty close.
Yeah, pretty close. It gets complicated with the consumer owns depending on how much electricity they actually supply right now.
I will. Well, the only other thing is I think there's only one investor-owned utility in one consumer-owned utility in Oregon that is supplying more than 3%. That would probably be in your area, Mr. Chair. And so none of the other consumer-owned utilities would actually have broached the 3%. And under current law, they would be only required to go up 5% if they acquire territory. But under this law, they would have to reach the full whatever the investor-owned utility was then required to do, which I believe is by the time this happened would be 20%.
Correct. If there was acquisition without consent.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is absolutely going to be the case.
Charging ahead.
Move on. I can go through the rest of this more quickly.
Well, don't worry about that.
All right.
It's more important that we understand.
All right. So that's those provisions. And again, we can address maybe the finer points of that a little bit better in an opinion or research conducted by our office if you have more questions. Or you can always just come by and talk to me. I'm going to skip over to page 9. Section 9, I think it's important to note here, the heading says recovery of costs for complying with renewable portfolio standard. And I want to just mention here, for the sake of being clear, Section 9 actually doesn't change the existing law that much. Right now there's an automatic adjustment clause for rate recovery for utilities in order to meet RPS standards. We didn't really change the law that much there. All we did is we folded in to that automatic adjustment clause energy storage, because that's come online since this was first written in 2005. And then we changed the process by which an electric company can request the automatic adjustment clause to be applied slightly. By the electric company can then come in and request the date on which it would start.
So where is that at?
That is page 9, lines 30 for associated energy storage, and lines 41 through 44 for changing the process slightly. I just wanted to be clear that there is not a lot going on in there, and the heading might be slightly misleading given that it's written more broadly. Section 11 on page 10. exemption for purposes of meeting reliability standards of North American Electric Reliability Corporation. These are federal standards, federal guidelines. They would have an impact of possibly preempting certain state law in given circumstances. This gives a process by which RPS compliance standards can be excused if you're going to have trouble meeting those, if the RPS requirements are going to give trouble to utility of meeting those guidelines and standards. So that's really what this section does. That is the bulk of the RPS sections. There are other things that are occurring in there, but I think that those are the most important things. General regulatory provisions starting on page 11. I'm going to go through these fairly quickly. Again, acquisition of electric company service territory or property. Section 14 really requires stranded cost obligations to be met if there is an acquisition. In order to prevent shifting of costs from the consumers of the territory from which service territory is acquired, the company from which service territory is acquired, to the other company. So if there's going to be shifting of costs that occur because of that condemnation process, then those shifting of costs will be accounted for underneath this section. I believe PUC could probably speak better to how that would be implemented than I can. On page 12, tax credit tracking. I'm just going to read this and allow PUC to kind of follow up on how they would implement this if they want to testify to that.
Can I stop you for a second?
Yes, Senator Byers.
I'm sensitive to make sure that we're not changing anything in existing law. The Section 13, those changes there, what's the effect of that?
Section 13?
Yeah.
Where we're adding and making these
general regulatory provisions.
What we are doing with the reason I created that heading and we're placing series placement these particular provisions, 14, 15, and 16 in ORS Chapter 757, we're not changing any existing law so much as we're adding new sections of law to direct PUC to create new programs or new methodologies. The reason that we're adding it into their general regulatory statutes is for purposes of picking up definitions and general regulatory powers, such as civil penalty powers or rulemaking powers. So that's why we're adding it into their general regulatory powers, those statutes.
Okay, thank you.
Page 12, tax credit tracking. This basically allows the Public Utility Commission or directs the Public Utility Commission to establish the means by which an electric company can track and credit or charge customers for the difference between state or federal production tax credits included in rates charged by electric company and actual production tax credits received by the electric company. So electric company, it would allow those the difference between those particular tax credits be accounted for in rates. And again, PUC is probably much better at discussing how that would be implemented than I am.
That kind of process usually is handled in a rate case. Why are we calling it out special here?
My understanding is that there was a rate case, there was a docket that addressed this issue earlier, and you might want to ask the Public Utility Commission about that. I have read that order, but I would not be as good at testifying to it as maybe somebody from the commission.
Okay. Can I take you back just to 14? Most of this, the acquisition language, most of this is covered under Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. They're the one who deal with this stuff. Why do we have this in here as a state statute?
That's really a policy question, I believe. I will say that there is language here that directs the commission to evaluate the stranded cost obligations from a permissive standpoint in accordance with those federal standards. So it does provide language saying PUC evaluate this. But really why it's in there is a policy question.
Yeah, it's usually an issue that in the past, at least cases, it's really falls under FERC. But I'll ask the PUC about that.
Yes, sir.
The other end.
I have a question along that same line, Mr. Chair, on the tax credit tracking. My understanding that the cost of electricity is usually just a pass-through, and there's a rate case made on that pass-through. But this wording, and I'm certainly no expert, but this wording appears to make the transfer of a production tax credit from the taxpayer to the ratepayer a prudently incurred cost. And if it is a prudently incurred cost, then does that allow the investor-owned utility to make a profit on that 2%?
Chair Beyer, Senator Whitsitt, no. My reading is that this would not allow for a profit to occur. It's merely directing PUC to come up with a mechanism by which the difference between these tax credits can be accounted for, probably for ease of figuring out how that is actually going to be accounted for in rates for the public, for the utility. It doesn't allow for any rate increase or costs to be collected. It just allows for the difference to be figured.
It might be best to ask that of the PUC.
Correct. But it doesn't allow for rate increase in any way. Really just cost difference being accounted for is what the language allows for.
Excuse me, I don't quite follow that. If the taxpayer is currently paying that 2% and when that 2% expires, when the tax credit expires, if the ratepayer is going to pay that 2%, then it would be an increased rate, it would seem.
Again, let's let the PUC address that.
Yeah, the language is fairly sparse here. What allows for is the difference to be accounted for. If that actually would impact rates, it would be an indirect impact that I would not be able to testify to. What I can say is the language does not approve, or the language does not allow for rate increases directly. It only allows for a difference to be accounted for. Transportation electrification programs, section 18. Basically, this is fairly standard language. It was modeled after the California statute, I believe, that directs electric companies to submit proposals to the Public Utility Commission for purposes of basically setting up depreciable electric car charging stations and other related equipment, and for those to be accounted for in rates. That's basically what allows for. Are there any specific questions about this?
Yeah, I have a kind of a canned question here. Apparently, the commission, the PUC, in a 2012 order, it is my understanding that this order was established to ensure a competitive market for investments in charging infrastructure and electric vehicles while protecting ratepayers. Why should ratepayers be paying the electric vehicles charging stations when there is a private market knocking on the door with private investors wanting to build and expand here? So I apologize. That's kind of a canned question that was given to me. But it seems like we are taking away the private incentive to put up these stations. And I understand that there are a lot of private investors that want to invest in that.
Senator Beyer, Senator Girard, that again is more of a policy question to ask of the utilities and some other people. I can't attest to whether or not it's good policy or not, obviously, from my position.
Sure.
But what I can say is that it basically it creates a process by which something that is already allowed by order by PUC to occur. It creates a process by which that will occur on a certain timeline, which is that the electric companies are going to actually come up with proposals and submit them to PUC. Those proposals will be consistent with the findings by the legislature in subsection 1 of section 18, and as well as having to meet certain mandates, which are on, if you look at line 45 on page 13, and lines 1 through 7 on page 14, those are the criteria that have to be met for the proposals to be accepted. So if you want to look through those, that is the criteria by which they would be able to establish charging stations and other types of equipment.
But to follow up, the ratepayer would pay for these charging stations. Is that not correct?
Yeah. If you look on page 14, lines 8 through 12 and 17, fairly standard tariff schedule and rate allowance language. Tariff schedules and rates allowed pursuant to subsection 3 of this section may allow a return on investment and shall be recovered from all customers and electric company in a manner that is similar to the recovery of distribution system investments. The important language there is all customers. You could probably ask PUC about the similarities or what that means when we hook it up with distribution system investments type language. They would be a little bit better at answering the specifics of that question.
I encourage you to ask that question, Mr. Eisdorf, when he's up.
Yeah.
Contrasted with what's already law.
Senator Thompson? I just want to make a comment. This part of the bill really bothers me, too. It's like take from the poor and give to the rich. We got people out there that can barely pay their electric bill, and it's going to go to charging stations for $100,000 cars. I understand why this is in there, but I don't get it.
And I have one question on this, if I could.
Are you done? That was a comment, not a question. Senator Whitsitt.
With these EV charging stations, the bill appears to be silent on whether the people who are charging the cars at these EV charging stations are going to be charged for electricity. Are they going to be charged for the electricity, or is it free?
That's a very good question. I don't know the answer to it. I have to go back and research it.
Thank you.
The bill doesn't address that.
Yeah, the bill doesn't address it on its face. But again, how it would be implemented, it might be better answered by industry or the commission.
Again, colleagues, I'm not sure that provision, while some may not like it, is that much different than existing law, but we can ask the PUC how it's interpreted when they come up.
Correct. The final piece that I want to cover is community solar programs. This does establish a program by which community solar projects, there will be proposals submitted by, Public Utility Commission will come up with programs for each electric company to implement that would require them to acquire a certain amount of power from community solar projects. Without going into too much detail here, community solar project is basically a single solar energy generating facility whereby subscribers, different people, they can basically lease or buy or however else put some money into it, and then they will get a benefit from the energy that is produced or generated by that facility. So that's what it does. It allows for, my understanding is that it allows for people who don't have the ability to set up solar panels on their houses or other places to basically have the ability to go ahead and invest in those types of, that type of generation, that type of electricity generation.
Senator Durant?
What rate are they going to be reimbursed for the power they create then?
Correct. They would be reimbursed through their electric bill, the way that this is currently written. There would be an offset to their electric bill.
Okay. Senator Thompson?
And I'm assuming there's something in here that says consumers going to pay for the subsidy for that? Is there anything for that part of it?
No, there is. This is written a little bit differently. The way that this is set up is that the costs and benefits of these projects, for the most part, are going to be borne by the owners and operators and subscribers to the project. The idea is that they're going to be funding it. There are certain carve-outs that allow a small, I don't know if it's a small piece, probably have to ask the commission about that, but some of the costs to be recoverable in rates. Startup costs for starting up the program, but once the program is up and running, all administrative costs also have to be borne by the subscribers and owners of these projects. So most of the language directs the costs and benefits and risks to be borne by people who are involved with the project itself instead of ratepayers.
General ratepayers.
Can I clarify one thing, Mr. Chief?
Go ahead, Senator.
If I understand the wording right, the investor-owned utilities also may own and operate and manage these community solar projects. Is that correct?
The bill allows them to own. Correct.
Other questions?
It doesn't require them to, though. They could also acquire it through power purchase agreements.
Okay, more?
I think that is the highlights of the bill. There are various miscellaneous provisions and a few other minor substantive provisions, but I think that handles it. Sorry for going so long.
No, perfectly fine. Trying to get an understanding of a very complex bill.
Right. Thank you.
Any other questions before we let Mr. Mayor go?
I think we're waiting with bated breath for the PUC.
Bated breath. Okay. Thank you, Mark. Most appreciated. Jason. PUC hasn't had this much attention since 2001.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I'm Jason Eisdorf, Program Director at the Public Utility Commission. So I am trying not to get any more headlines than we need to, but I really am here just as a resource. So I'm happy to address issues of process, larger policy or smaller policies. So it's really a matter of where you want to go and the kinds of issues that you want to explore.
Let me throw you a general one. Is there, in traditional rate-making setting, the emphasis or the responsibility is upon the utility to bring a case and present that and defend that case? Is there anything in this that changes that in any way?
Chair Beyer, there's little pieces here and there, but for the most part it doesn't fundamentally change how the commission is going to react to a lot of this. It does, I think I've addressed this committee before and talked about integrated resource planning, about how the utility, electric utilities and natural gas utilities, every 2 years have to come forward to the commission with a plan of how to serve projected load in the least cost, least risk manner. And sort of by definition, establishing a 50% RPS is largely telling the commission and the utility the kind of resource in general. That's not terribly different than the current renewable portfolio standard, which is 25% by 2025. I think one of the issues, it's probably no secret that the commission had some issues with the bill. One of the issues, I think, is that there was not a lot of language in here devoted to trying to diversify ownership and types of resources. So the way the bill is written, in theory, the utility could come forward with ownership of all of these resources and rate base them and earn a return on them. So that was an issue, that there wasn't a lot of language here that sort of suggested that a way to open up opportunities for other developers, different kinds of ownership structure, different kinds of resources even. It's pretty much of a blunt instrument.
Wouldn't they still, in an acquisition, have to go through your established bidding process or RFP process to demonstrate prudence?
So the several years ago, the commission did issue an order establishing guidelines for when a utility is going out and getting resources through, and it set a limit of 100 megawatts above which the utility had to run through RFP and actually engage in a stakeholder process. I think one issue that's out there is whether or not that number is the right number, whether that number should come down and require the utility at a smaller threshold to go out with a competitive bid. At 100 megawatts, you can utility could sort of acquire a fair amount of renewables that way without having to go out competitively.
Is the ability to make that, to lower that threshold, is that within their realm of PUC's current authority, or do you need statutory change?
It's always helpful to have statutory change. I don't think... I think it's probably within the authority of the commission. It's not stated clearly in this bill, so I think we'd have to sort of go through that process.
Let's just hit it head on. The provision in here that has to do with the tax credits.
So that was one of the issues where the commissioners felt that is Section 16. That was a ruling that came out of the commission recently that was sort of contrary to the language here. You know, there's complicated issues of what the intent is. I think the commission sort of felt that if there was an issue with their order that they had just determined that it would have been taken up and discussed. I told when I testified on the House side, I made mention of the commission's public process. I honestly and truthfully think that the commission's public process is as open and transparent as it gets in state Oregon state government. We invite all stakeholders to come. We go through a rigorous process. My staff develops its own case, and the commission takes those cases very seriously. Revisit this in statute, I think I would say in a process that is not as transparent was, I think, irksome to the commissioners.
I guess I'm not particularly interested or concerned about the commission's feelings about it. What I would like to know is there something about that that may have not been to doing it this way as opposed to the way you're doing it that is not to the benefit of the ratepayers?
I think the way in Section 16, arguably, it reduces the risk to the utility. It gets it matches up the expiration of the tax credits more quickly. On the one hand, it's not irrational. On the other hand, when the commission establishes rates and establishes a rate of return, it takes the risk to the utility into account. And so I suppose if this were to pass in law, that would be something that the commission would look at when determining rate of return.
I'll share.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Eisdorfer, along that same line, I have here an email from Chair Ackerman from the PUC. And the gist of it is the last draft of the bill that she had perused reversed at least two PUC decisions, the treatment of variable costs for renewable resources, and second, when and how the utilities may reflect production tax credits in their rates. And the bill requires the PUC to revisit decisions already made on the following topics, respecting when and how cost of transportation electrification activities may be funded with electricity ratepayer dollars, and then the treatment of the long-term value of utility resource projects. So apparently, it's my understanding that the Public Utility Commission is, their primary function is to regulate investor-owned utilities. It almost seems here in this bill that the investor-owned utilities are regulating the PUC. So would you comment?
Chair Beyer, Senator Whitsitt. You ultimately establish the statutes under which the commission operates. If you pass this bill, we will implement it, and we'll do a good job at it. I think in talking about the process, it was an interesting process. I think the proponents visited the commissioners individually on December 18th and largely told the commissioners what was going to go forward in the bill. That was, I think, a point at which at least some of the commissioners got a little riled up. And then it wasn't until another couple of weeks later, but I think 10 days later, is when we first saw some legal language. And then it was another couple of weeks after that until we saw the LC. At no point during that period of time did the proponents really come to us and ask us our opinion, help in attempting to make this work for the commission. And in that, it was unusual. I've been with the commission 4 years. I've been in the electricity biz for 16 years beyond that. And in major changes to energy policy, there's usually a period of time prior to an LC draft where there's some discussion, a back-and-forth discussion between the proponent and the commission. And so in that regard, this process was, I think, a little bit different. But Senator, to your point, I mean, it's and perhaps to Senator Byer's point, what the commission thinks and what you think are two different things. And if you think the policy is appropriate, that's the policy that we will implement.
Just a quick question. We're about to run out of time.
We're going to bring Jason back Monday, I hope.
Okay.
Okay. That's it for us. Yeah, we're running into the next committee. You want got a question that you?
No, I can go ahead.
I did want to just very quickly, Senator Whitsitt asked some questions about the capacity factors and what's your observation on what we have now in the capacity factors for, and we probably don't have on solar, but on wind.
On wind, they can range generally in the Columbia Gorge. I think we're in the 30-something percent. Wyoming wind can be as up into the 40s, low 40s.
Well, that's what I was thinking. The numbers that you were saying were a little lower than what I had observed. Thank you, Jason.
See you next
we'll
week.
See you again.
Thank you.
Anything else before we adjourn? We are adjourned for the day. We will be taking this up again at our next. We are adjourned for the day. We will be taking this.